All right, Manny, Alberto, great to see you guys.
How's it going? Always nice to see you. Last time we saw each other was in a little bit of a cigar lounge.
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. That was nice. Manny supplied, I think, 50% of the alcohol and 50% of the cigars. It was lovely. I think I smelled like ashtray for 3 days after.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't notice it. Well, there's nobody around me to notice, so it doesn't matter to me.
I think I smelled it like in the car. I was like, man, is there an ashtray in here? Like, what's going on?
Were you wearing your jacket?
I had my jeans on, and my jeans, I was like, I got to put like a scent booster in here to get this thing out.
But it was a good evening. Lots of conversation. It was great talk. And yeah, there was a few little drinks here and there and some smoking, and that was it.
And that creates the atmosphere though, right? That's the thing with cigars.
Yeah.
It creates an environment that everything else opens up, right? So.
Yeah, I know. I think it was like the first one you organized there. So hopefully you can do it again and obviously have a bigger crowd. I think it was like 30 of us.
Yeah.
It was a good crowd.
Yeah.
It was totally a good crowd. It was a good conversation. That's what I like. I was thanking him over and over because it was, well, I needed it. I basically looked at it that way. It was almost like therapy that evening.
Yeah.
To me.
The irony was we were in the cigar lounge and I was there and then I literally got an invite for another one for like a week later. I was like, the irony to this is comical.
But see, there's the thing, I think that you just illuminated something that's tremendously important is the therapy. The things we don't do enough because we get so consumed with the day-to-day transactional things and the distractions and the dings and the bings and the buzzes. Somebody's pulling at your attention where, you know, the nice thing about that night, I went to bed with a smile on my face and I didn't have a cigar, I didn't have a drink. I was in the environment and I just chose those decisions for that evening, but I still went to bed. I was like, this is who I am. This makes me feel energized. Great people, wonderful conversation. No agendas. It was like, holy shit, man. Whatever we talk about is what we talk about. And there's always something that you just take away from it.
I thought it was really neat to sort of talk to different people in different professions. And we all had these sort of commonalities in different ways, even though we were like in completely different industries, that we would just share things like, yeah, that makes sense for us. It's, you know, in this manner, but for you, obviously in your industry, it's this specific, but it was just neat to kind of share the commonalities amongst everyone.
Yep.
So I think that was probably the funnest part for me.
Collaboration, right? Human beings were never meant to be alone.
But when did we stop that?
Well, actually we were just pivoting through that and you were talking about the importance, especially about men's health, to have those interactions.
Right? Yeah, it's like there was one study that came out, I think it was like a little while ago, talking about how imperative it is for men's health to have that sort of guys' night once to two times a week. But, you know, it's obviously difficult to kind of make sure you get into that routine just because you'll have various commitments, family, work-wise,
sure,
right, kids and things like that. So, you know, it's just whether or not that individual then equally prioritizes that, right? So, but there is a commonality to where you do need that, right? It is that mental break, that social health, right? People always think of like just health is one compartment, but like that social component is so imperative. So yeah, it's one thing that you should be able to do. It kind of gives you that release from the mundane day to day.
So, and sometimes we just need a bitch session. Sometimes you just gotta get it out. Yeah. You guys both met my friend James 25 years we go back. Him and I talk minimum once a week. And some, you know, whether it's business, professional, or sometimes it's just like, this is what I'm dealing with, man. You know, either be a sounding board for me or give me some insight.
But why do we stop?
Well,
it's the same thing for physical activity. Like, we just keep on getting older, and I guess we compound, our thoughts compound how difficult it is to start.
Yeah, that would be like a barrier, but then equally too, sometimes people get very complacent, right? Within how their life maybe take form. And then so they don't prioritize that and then consider that of an important part to their health.
Yep.
So maybe that lack of awareness to start, and then you throw on top of a barrier. But we equally full well know that how important that is to our health. So, you know, it's about educating and informing, okay, and then coming back into that, right? And oftentimes you usually sort of hear like it's very difficult to get away from the family to have a guy's night, or you feel guilty about leaving the family to then go have a guy's night.
Do you think the girls do it more often than the guys? Have a night out?
Yeah, it's hard to know whether they do it more or not. I think they're better at it just because women are much more social than men. So they're better at ensuring that does get maintained in their life. Whereas men, they're a lot less social in nature. So it's a bit, requires almost more effort for them to actually orchestrate that. So it's not that one's, you know, necessarily better per se, but it's equally important, right? And it like you know, when we had that cigar night with James, like, it was lovely chatting to him. I think I talked to him for several hours on end, but, you know, it's just like a form of an expression to release, right? And we just shared a lot of common points, and it was just, you know, having fun, just, you know, just sharing jokes and, yep, and our day-to-day that we had a lot in common.
There's no judgment. That's what it was. Basically, yeah, there was no judgment there.
Yeah, right? it was a fun space just to kind of talk freely and, you know, kind of get away from the day-to-day.
How long was that? Like 3 weeks or a month ago? When did we do that?
I'd say three or four months. The 11th, I think it was the 11th of April.
I lost track, man.
I don't know.
Whenever you sent out that message, I just said yes. Count me in. That was it.
What do you guys want to chat about today, man? I know you had some talking points that you brought up.
I think there's a bunch of different things. First of all, it's interesting we pivot right into the mental emotional side of things. Because oftentimes I've heard you say from a clinician standpoint, much of what you do, is the therapy piece of it, is the listening and the responding.
Yeah, so I always make the common rhetoric joke of, I use the second half of my job title more than the first half, therapist over physio. And it's about managing the individual as it is to their injury in nature. And what we know about pain science, it's biopsychosocial. So very little to it is the actual physical nature in which their issue persists. So, you know, how does their injury permeate into their ability to provide an income? Are they single parents to, you know, three kids? They can't work. So that will highly accentuate their pain more than what it is to their actual physical nature. They often will, times people have an injury or pain and they associate an emotion to it, right? Like, you know, when you think of your neck pain, for example, was there an onset that makes you feel a specific way? And so oftentimes there's an emotion attached to their injury, right? So can we disconnect that? And oftentimes once you can unpack that, you'll find more outcomes than just say, okay, you know, your injury is a physical nature. This is what we got to do in a traditional sense. But realistically speaking, it's so emotionally charged that, right, okay, let's kind of unpack that first. And then we can come into sort of those mechanical aggravating factors that are causing their neck pain.
But you do something very different that's always excited me about, you know, our relationship, is that you find a way purposefully, and you're really good at it, is connecting with people first. So you oftentimes connect to understand who the human being is, and then you can bring in the practical, the science-based knowledge to you know, solve an issue. We were talking that same night where, you know, you brought up an individual that was experiencing some things, you know, with you know, his foot, and after connecting about that, Albert was very able to say, consider this. And I think, as you had shared, that was exactly it, right?
Yeah.
The connection started. It wasn't just, hey, I'm going to fix the problem. I want to connect. I want to understand. By understanding that the symptoms of things, then you can bring in the science behind that.
And that goes deeper into the clinical reasoning. Like, I have a few, like, physio residents and new grads that, you know, I'm mentoring them to kind of teach them. And so it's about how we think, right? More than telling them what someone to do. We get very reactive in nature, so you can't really truly help anyone. But yes, you want to build, like, in that scenario, as much as I'm, like, connecting with the individual and I'm trying to build the history, understand everything first, that, like, okay, here's what, you know, your actual issue is. Is it in relation to, you know, the onset, or is it in relation to something else? Because we need to unpack the full history of it, the full story of it, to really understand. And equally so, to your point, yeah, you want to connect. It's very, very important, because in order to help someone's shoulder, you have to help the individual, right? Yeah. And so it's a full picture. And much like when I tell, like, my current staff, is that, like, as much as you are there to help the individual, invest in the relationship more than anything, right? And you help them in a sort of level in which it'll be different for each person. And so long as you invest in building the relationship, that whatever that looks like, because it'll be different for each individual, because each one will have individual needs, parameters, capabilities, etc. But invest in the relationship, understand the full picture of what's going on, and then you can truly help them. And that's fundamentally what the job is, you know, helping someone to the best of your abilities.
Is that the job is first?
Should be.
Understanding, right?
Well, yeah, you need to understand. Like, so, like, if I don't understand the problem, how can I help you? And that's transparent across any industry. Like, if it's a service, it's a product. Like, if we don't understand the problem or the issue or how we can help, then how could I truly do my job?
I'm curious, when it comes to your patients, is it just human nature how we react when there's something that's wrong with us physically?
At
different ages, like, do we, like, you brought up earlier, you're talking about as a kid, and I think we were doing an off a mic or something like that. Concussions, and then just like you hit your head, you fell off a bike, you twirled right over it, or you jumped off the garage, or whatever, you did something, and mm-hmm. then you just, like, you dusted yourself off, and you kept on going. There could be an injury in your body at some point, but as a kid, that's how you react to it. But as an adult, I guess it starts to change the older you get.
It doesn't necessarily change as much as, like, your resiliency will be slightly different. Like, when you're a kid, for the most part, one, maybe the impact of trauma or the force behind an impact won't be as great as what it might be when you're an adult. Mm. When you're a kid, you tend to be a little bit more resilient, but they're also equally not exposed to dangers, if you will, in terms of moments where they can truly hurt themselves, because there's typically a parent nearby that you'll protect them a bit. So it's not necessarily how they react. When you're an adult, you try to dust it off and try to move on with your day. With the kids, they'll typically cry, give them the attention they need, and try to help them. But it's just more so by the circumstance and nature than anything else.
I'm just saying, as an adult, the pain is still there, but you're ignoring it.
Oh, yeah.
Versus the kid takes the pain, reacts to it instinctively, and then either it heals itself and moves on, or gets treatment for it. But the adult will ignore it, and it's still there. And so I'm trying to figure out, at what point does the adult, mostly men, I guess, will come to you? It's how long has it been going on? You probably hear a long timeline instead of a short timeline.
Yeah, and it's usually, and I think we were talking about that at that night there at the event, whereas, like, they're typically not going to come and see me, especially men in the old school.
Not right away.
No. And they're typically going to be very stubborn, a little old school in nature, where it's like, I'll just go on with it. They only will come and see me, and I see it all the time, until it truly debilitates their everyday life or work. So it needs to be so debilitating where it's, I can't walk anymore. Now I'm going to get it looked at. And then that's when they see me. And like, well, we could have helped you a lot quicker. Now we're going to have to take a little bit longer to get to a point where you can feel really comfortable and then move forward beyond that. But yeah, it's typically with kids, right? Pain, you help them immediately because you know they can't help themselves. Right, let's take you to someone who can. When it's us, okay, well, we got work. We don't do the same, right? Like, well, it's because we'll have other responsibilities that we'll prioritize above it, right? So what is it that we always prioritize? And so typically in those sort of scenarios, right, well, I'll prioritize my work, my family, my kids, this, that, or the other. So there's a long list of things that you prioritize first before you prioritize yourself. Not necessarily what you should be doing, but until they then realize, right, okay, now it's impacting my ability to do all the things I prioritize above myself, that it's affecting that I need now to get, obviously, treated. And so it typically happens in that facet.
Can I add something to this?
Yeah.
This is interesting the way you're saying prioritize. And there's something that shows up for me, and I'm going to throw this word out because it was making me smile. The word stubborn.
Mm.
And I believe that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think everyone is.
I think there's
but it's also a good trait, too. Within
what do you mean? Okay, reason. Well, I think of when I thought of the word stubborn, I thought of the stubbornness like, I'm just not going to deal with it right now, and I'm going to suppress it and suppress it and suppress it until it either...
Well, yeah.
But you're saying...
I think mine is stubborn from the kid, where I think the pain will go away because I'm a Superman and I can heal myself. Yeah. But that's not reality.
Well, we all think we're invincible until we're not. And so then, yeah. But no, like when I was saying stubborn as like a good trait, like it's a healthy within context, right? But yeah, you don't want to be stubborn to the point where you're, you know, arrogant and you're ignoring things.
Where it becomes like now it's going to affect your way of life later on.
Yeah.
That's stubborn stupidity, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, or like, even current way of life, right? And you're just like, okay, when you know, you didn't address your foot. This is real. I just learned the other day. My dad hurt his foot 2 days ago. He's in Florida. Right? My mother's like, oh, you know, your dad, this is why it's top of mind. Oh, your dad's stubborn. He's on crutches.
Like, so now he's added crutches to the mix, he's adding, right?
And he isn't going to a doctor. He's self-diagnosing, right? And oh, I'm going to wait till I get home in 2 weeks and go see the doctor. But a doctor's going to do what? You got pain? You know, take Advil, right? Address the issue, folks. And that's why I'm saying...
But that's a good point.
Yeah.
So maybe we have this thought process. But when we, like, last time I went to my medical family doctor, whatever, it's a script.
Yeah.
It's always been a script. It's never been anything else.
Yeah. It's one of those things where typically doctors are really good now that they'll say, like, if it's like an MSK orthopedic scenario, that they're probably not going to know it full well to help them, right? So they'll say, right, go to see a physio. They'll be able to kind of help you with telling you a bit more detail, and then obviously then treating it, versus them traditionally giving you a script and then out the door you go. Equally too, to on let's say my profession's part, is that a lot of people actually don't know what we do, right? Mm-hmm. It's the thing of physio. If I were to ask you, like, you know, what is your interpretation of a physio? And what is it they do, or how can they help you, right? Like, people actually don't even know the true value of what a physio is.
Meet Jonathan Sinelli, the visionary behind People First Leadership. Jonathan is not your average leadership coach. His People First Leadership approach focuses on putting people at the core of your strategy, creating workplaces where teams thrive and achieve outstanding results. What sets him apart? Jonathan is a master at asking thought-provoking questions that spark genuine conversations and challenge conventional thinking. His deep empathy helps him understand unique challenges and guide people toward impactful solutions. As an accomplished author, media host of the People First podcast, and seasoned project management expert with a background as an electrician, Jonathan offers unparalleled experience and practical insights. Whether you're interested in a one-on-one coaching or breakout room sessions, Jonathan customizes his approach to your needs. He also travels the world, speaking at conferences and business events, inspiring leaders with his dynamic presentations. Discover how People First Leadership can transform your approach and ignite your team's potential with Jonathan Sinelli. Call Jonathan at 416-717-4139 or email him at jc@jonathansinelli.com. Or reach out to him on his website at jonathansinelli.com. This message is proudly supported by the Construction Life podcast. My thought process of physio would be the way your body used to move as a child before it started experiencing life. Their job is to get that body to that position, back to that position.
Yeah.
Flexibility, joint movement, standing, sitting, walking, stuff like that. That you're contributing to what damage we've caused to our body over the course of life.
To a fundamental degree, yes, in one particular component, right? Because we're this sort of beautiful blend of being someone who is responsible for so many different things, right? First and foremost, physio is a medical medical field,
yeah,
right? So there's a medical component that we're very much responsible for, and then obviously then the treatment side of it, like in that scenario, that would be more like the commonality of it, right? Yeah. But I could tell you there's pediatric physios for kids.
I'm generalizing.
No, I know.
I'm just saying, you know, aches and pains and reasons why you have those.
And that's what I mean, where it's not really done the profession a service, is that, like, that's what only people really think of, right? Mm. And it to be even then more transparent, is that, like, people will think of that profession or our profession is that it'll be so dispersed or varied in what they think of it, right? Or what their interpretation is of it. And so then that's where a lot of that then comes on to where some doctors will say, which still exists, well, you don't need physio. What is physio going to do, right? They don't believe in it. Or some will say, go to physio. Or some will say, hold off on physio.
Is he saying that while he's writing a script?
To be honest, I don't know, right? Like, there's so many, like, medical practitioners who will have different perspective and views on how they sort of work. It should be in a scenario where it should be, you know, physios are sort of in that forefront, right? For any MSK or orthopedic stuff, because we are medically trained.
Yeah.
So our very first job is when we see someone, is it medical or mechanical, right? Like, so for example, like, let's say, you know, I had one scenario where I can think of off the top of my head. It was a child, jaw pain, no, like, specific onset, right? As I unfold and unpack it, I'm like, this is sound like juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, right?
Okay.
I'm going to unpack this further. Hey, listen, like, here's kind of what it could be if it's not this, right? Equally trying not to scare the parent. But I think you should probably go and see whether you have a pediatrician or your family doctor to follow up. And I'll be more than happy to provide a letter sort of indicating this. And sure enough, it was, right? And that happens more often than not, right? Not necessarily for that specific case, right? But my job is it medical or otherwise, right? And so we are medically trained to know that, involve that knowledge in the background to then help the individual for anything, right? Similar to what Jonathan was talking about his dad, as we go off into a massive tangent here, is that, like, people simplify the issue. Like, oh, it hurts, I'll come off of it, then my pain will stop and then I'm fine, right? So they try to self-manage it without really knowing what's going to help or what's going to hurt. And it's that disconnect where I always talk about it in clinic is pain doesn't necessarily mean you're doing better or worse, or it's indicative of something that's going on, right? Because like in that scenario there, I imagine, let's say just if it's a rolled ankle, I think you said, correct?
I'm not sure the details.
Sure. Let's just go with a rolled ankle. Is that if you don't move, it doesn't hurt. Does that mean you're fine? Mm-hmm. No. So instantly we know clearly pain is not necessarily representative of anything, right? So if you don't move, you don't feel pain. Does that mean you're fine to get up and walk? No, because it hurts when you weight bear. Okay, so that's telling you your limitation with weight bearing, right? So, but then as you then, let's say you're undergoing treatment, you'll progress further and further, but you'll still experience pain. But now you won't experience pain with weight bearing. You'll experience pain with going upstairs, but your pain is still present. That doesn't mean it's not getting better, right? So objectively, you're able to do more with the same level of pain. And so people will always interpret, well, I still have pain. That doesn't, it means like this must, like physio's not working, my treatment's not working, something's going on. No, objectively speaking, you're able to do more with the same level of pain. And that's what progress is, right? It's about understanding that I can tolerate more, and you continue tolerating more until you have no more pain. And that's when you're fine. If that makes sense.
But do people see that where they?
No, they don't. No, because like
the pain is still there. It's at one level, but they have more range of movement, whatever it is. They're not realizing that it's getting better, but the pain is still there.
They won't. It has to be obvious in the objective.
Really?
Yes. Right. And so then different injuries will be easier to quantify or see it. So people will always impart what is the most obvious to them. So how I feel, you internalize that. I still feel pain, right? It's so apparent to them that, well, it's pain. I still feel pain. So like something's going on. I don't feel better because I'm still experiencing pain. And because that is so overwhelming or might be so frequent, that's all they can see. And so that's one of the big parts of our job, right? Is identify, inform them of what progress actually is. You know, for a wrist, 2 degrees of movement in relation to how much you have in totality of your wrist, which isn't a lot. Let's say in one specific movement, it's only 25 degrees of normality of movement. So 2 degrees, that's 10%. Let's just say for fun, that's big. But you're not going to recognize 2 degrees in your wrist. Whereas a shoulder, you can recognize 10 degrees. Oh, I can move it now. Let's say to my shoulder height. Okay, now that's not pain-free. So it's more obvious. But then equally so, as you feel better and tolerate more, you naturally do more, and then it'll hurt.
Are we, as human beings, just so used to pain and discomfort? I ate too much, you know what I mean? Or I overexerted myself too much in the gym. Or like are we questionable when we don't have any pain? I feel great. Everything's good. And then like, what's wrong? Something's wrong. Are we like that as just human beings?
I think as human beings, we just try to persevere, push on. I think now we're doing a lot better at trying to push on through pain and, you know, not necessarily succumb to it to a degree. I see a lot of people, especially people who are pretty active. They're like, yeah, I feel like let's say my shoulder, but I still try to push through it. And then either pay the consequence or somehow maybe get through it, right, to a certain point. I think it's just being very cognizant within yourself, right? Okay, like, is this something I can push through? Is this something I'm not? Like, that's where maybe, like, hey, just a quick consult. Like, hey, is this something I can push through? Just a mini management might help, right? So you can go and see a physio. Be like, okay, you know, this is pretty minor. It's pretty insignificant. This is kind of the parameters in which we want to push through, like, in clinic, like I'm never going to tell you not stop working out. Like, you know, with Jonathan, there's been a couple examples where it's like, okay, this isn't something to be too worrisome. He kind of wants that reference check, right? That's what we'll provide. It's not about, hey, your shoulder hurts, get out of exercise immediately. No, let's find a way for you to come into it. What is exactly going on? Is it severe? Is it going to impact further if you are pushing it? So we'll then obviously tailor it down, scale it down, provide a bit of, you know, management strategies to help them, right? Crack on in this fashion and then slowly go from there. But
yeah, to your point, pain, is it a pain that's as a result of, hey, we're growing, or pain as a result of, hey, we have to adjust, right? And there's a difference there, because sometimes you feel like, oh, my shoulder's sore. Well, is it sore because
a lot of people just want pain?
Because do you think
so? It makes them feel alive. Why do we exert ourselves on a job site? Like, we know that if you're digging or swinging a hammer or lifting a wall or, like, you know that there's a potential pain associated with this, and all of a sudden you do it, and then, surprise, surprise, pain. And so, okay, well, I pulled it off. Maybe that's a masculine mentality.
Then you feel good about it, yeah.
So, like I was going to say, so that comes down to accomplishment, right? Like, yeah. If you don't feel, and you hear it too in let's say, clinic, like, well, I don't want to do a workout half-assed. And I'm equally of the same mentality, all or nothing. Like, when I do something, I'm going to go all out. So you will exert yourself because then you can do something. You feel like you accomplished it, right? You gave its maximum effort.
Yeah.
You know, half-fasting it for the most part, you know, if we were to generalize, isn't something that any one person wants to do, right? On the construction site, you're going to be building something. So you want to go all out regardless of who you are in terms of, or sorry, not who you are, how you're feeling,
yeah.
Right? So you sacrifice yourself to build something. And that's because there's equally a sense of purpose behind it.
I'm just trying to think of, like, because I look at it, people question when everything's going, they don't pay attention to that everything's well, everything's good. They pay attention more when everything's not good. Mm-hmm. We're so focused on having negatives in our life. So that's why it was the pain part of it. I was thinking, okay, this is interesting. But then I recently learned too, and I didn't know this, that even if you have an injury, you still need to maintain some sort of movement going on, because the movement of the other part of the bodies that are still feeling good will contribute to the healing of the part that's not feeling good.
Yeah. And there's always things to work on too. And I think there's like two things to
kind of... But most people just shut their bodies down going, I've got a rolled ankle, or I've got a sore rotator cuff or something like that. I'm shutting down. I'm not going to do anything. But that's like a bad move.
Yeah, that's the worst, right? Like the rhetoric we say, rest is rust, motion is lotion. But yeah, but it goes back to what I was saying before, is that because they're internalizing pain as their issue and only monitoring how they're feeling as their primary source to manage it. So
yeah.
If I'm in pain, I'm going to do whatever I can to not be in pain, so I shut it down. But yes, you're not having pain when you're not moving or you shut it down, but the moment you move, you're going to have pain. And in fact, you'll actually have more pain if you do that, yeah. Because now your tolerance mm-hmm. is lessened. So you're becoming yeah. more intolerant to whatever activities you have to do. And that's where I was talking before, is that disconnect of providing that information of what progress is. It's not how you feel, because I already told you it's misrepresentative. If you do nothing, you feel no pain. If you do something, you feel pain. So if you feel no pain when you're doing nothing, does that mean you're fine? No.
But it's good to have a person like you as a physiotherapist to guide the person on at what point is this pain level at?
Yeah.
And your range of motion and things like that. Because as an individual, we won't really know. We only know what we're experiencing from the time that it happened to now. And we can't give ourselves, like you were talking about, that 10 degree, that 10% movement. We wouldn't know that as an individual.
No.
And we wouldn't be able to calculate that going, that's a huge difference, right? Mm-hmm. But then you're saying to us, that's a huge difference.
Yeah. And that's part of the clinician's job, right?
Yeah.
Like you would, like a good clinician would make sure to highlight that, because it can be very frustrating. Because And that's where I talk about, like, you know, that coaching, that mindset of the person, then more than the physical injury, that this process is very tiresome, because you're going to feel pain for so long in these hyperacute, subacute phases, because, well, you keep monitoring your progress based off how you feel, but that's not going to change because you're slowly becoming more tolerant. So it becomes very imperative for me to highlight your progress to you, because you can't see it.
Yeah.
And so it's to ease your frustration. And until you start to feel better and have less symptoms, which someone will, like that's just a matter of time, right? Then it becomes more easier to see. So the progress is obvious. So they can kind of settle in and relax, right? But those first little while, especially when they've ignored it for 2 years, and it's very, very impactful to their day-to-day, that it's going to take longer for them to see that, our job can be quite difficult in making sure this individual is not being frustrated by the process. And so there's a lot of managing the individual that goes into it to inform them of all these different moments that where it's still going to feel pain. You know, as you start to feel a little bit better, right, you'll stand on your feet for 2 minutes more in front of the sink. You'll then be standing with cooking. You know, you end up going in the grocery store for 10 minutes longer. That's a lot. And so you'll feel pain, but not realize what you've just done.
See, that's what I was saying about earlier about the kids. They just take the pain, overcome it, move on to the next one because another one's going to come, right?
Yep.
As an adult, they'll just ignore it. And now it becomes a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of us, I don't know, walking up the stairs a certain way, we've masked how we're going to walk up the stairs now to accommodate the pain that's in our life right now. Entering and exiting your vehicle, going in and outside or whatever it is, you're getting used to it instead of getting rid of it.
Well, it's less of getting used to it and more, so it's innate human behavior to avoid. It's an avoidance behavior. Mm-hmm. So whatever is hurting, so like you said, going down the stairs or up the stairs, what people will do is they will compensate. So they, let's say if their left ankle hurts, they're not going to use their left ankle going up or the stairs. They'll just use the right side. And so until it just genuinely hurts them in a debilitating sense, will they seek help. But they will just constantly find ways to lessen their pain by any means until a point where that's the bottom. Like there's nothing less you can restrict yourself from doing to feel less pain. And it's then when we come into play, okay, hey, like, listen, our pain here isn't going to change for the first little bit, but your tolerance will.
Yeah.
And so I will make sure to point this out to you and here's how you won't see it. And so this is what progress is. So I will establish that realistic expectation up front. And I in full well knowing I'm going to have to repeat this conversation a million times over with every session. But the moment I can establish that up front and set precedent with that is like, hey, do you remember what I said? And they're like, oh, yes. And it helps calm them down. Okay, great. And then in our next session, hey, you remember when you had pain doing this and now you don't? Oh, yeah, I'm doing more. Great, that's progress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So within each session, within ourselves in clinic, no two sessions are ever identical. In fact, they're wildly different. So they can see the progress they undertake within each session in those like sort of quote unquote dark days where if it's someone like that, where it's been 2 years of just complete avoidance behaviors, now it's so debilitating that, right, here's your progress again, here's your progress again. And then, right, it gets to a point where they can see, right, I'm having less pain or less frequent pain. And then they can really kind of be at ease and they're not frustrated anymore. And then that's quite literally when we have fun.
When it comes to spray foam and blown-in insulation for your next project, there's no better team than Mohammed and his crew at Foamit. With well-educated, skilled installers, Foamit doesn't just get the job done, they do it right. They take the time to properly estimate and educate you on every aspect of your project, ensuring your building envelope is airtight and energy efficient. As leaders in the industry, they bring a deep understanding of building science to every job, making sure your project stands the test of time. But don't just take their word for it. Past clients constantly praise the quality of work and professionalism of the Foamit team. From homeowners to large-scale contractors, feedback has been overwhelmingly positive, with clients appreciating their attention to detail, the thoroughness of their crew, and the results that speak for themselves. At Foamit, they pride themselves on building lasting relationships through exceptional service, reliability, and the commitment to exceeding expectations on every single project. Whether you're insulating a new build, upgrading an older property, or tackling a commercial project, Foamit is your trusted partner in achieving energy efficiency and comfort. They understand the importance of getting it right the first time, and that's why so many clients return to them for future projects. Connect with Foamit today. Reach them at 416-893-8712 or 647-961-9777. Email them at mohammed@foamit.ca or visit them at www.foamit.ca. Follow them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn to see their latest projects and innovations. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life. Nutrition, you want to talk about nutrition or?
Yeah, let's tie in, top of mind for me, I think I'd like to pivot to concussions because that was a real conversation we were having before. You know, I was talking about Cassandra having three concussions. So to the audience out there, 9 years old, Cassandra, three concussions, 4 months.
From?
Various things, hitting a wall, falling off of gymnastics rings, falling off the back of a golf cart, like just being a kid sometimes, you know, pushing boundaries, testing limits. And sometimes stupid shit happens. That's all you can do, right?
What's the best thing to do when you have a concussion?
Well, for me now, I'll tell you, I call him right away. Yeah. I didn't know this until my relationships flourished in the past several years. Because my mindset, even through all the athletic coaching I've done over the years and bringing my transfers and biases over the years of how to treat concussions, is very different because I've got information from all places. I can think of times as a child where I look back now, I've had multiple concussions and just kept going, right? And now the information we have is very different. So I'm going to pivot right over to you because recently, earlier this week, I was like, okay, Cassandra had a concussion on the weekend. She, you know, seemed fine. She seemed fine. Now, a couple of days later, we have symptoms. Hey, I'm going to come and see you. Mm-hmm. So take us through that scenario.
Yeah. So with concussions, like we were talking slightly before we started here about concussions. And so with them, it's not something that we're over-diagnosing. It was just something that before we weren't as aware. And so now it's obviously a bit more prevalent. Now with it is that with concussions, it doesn't necessarily require head trauma. It could just be sort of a whiplash mechanism because...
Really?
Yeah, your brain will kind of hit the front part of your skull and the back part of your skull. So you don't necessarily need impact, and force of impact doesn't mean more severe concussion. There's no actual association to it. So it's always something to be mindful of, that people kind of think really quickly, oh, just a knock, and well, that can't be a concussion. It could. I don't want to say equally so every head hit is a concussion. It's not. It's just that there's no association. So it's just something to be mindful of.
So a car accident. You get into a car accident and the belt saves you, but your head still goes forward.
Well, yeah. So a concussion will be a lot better of an outcome than potentially something more fatal. So with a seatbelt,
yeah.
Right? So the seatbelt's there to stop you from going through
the
windshield.
A little bit of your head, though,
yeah.
Before, I guess, the airbag is deployed, that's still a whiplash kind of effect to the head.
Yes, correct. So it can, yeah. Even too, it could just be like a non-contact, and I'll come back to Cassandra in a second. But for example, like let's just say in a sport-related injury, or you know, maybe you're at a social evening, but you can get like a push and a shove, and your head's going to move side to side, right? And that could induce one.
Wow.
So, you know, not to say that every shove is, right? But just something that people can be a bit more informed about.
Well, hang on there, though. Is there a tolerance? So somebody who is more prone to, or has had them recently, or even in that scenario, maybe there was an athlete who was in a social scenario who's coming off of a concussion, and a whiplash or a movement at a social event, that can trigger it, right?
Yeah.
How do we know the difference between tolerance levels?
So we won't know from a baseline tolerance level. Like that isn't something that we could just quite simply find out. We can sort of undergo testing to see if they have sustained a concussion. So like if someone has, let's say, a head injury, okay, you know, we'll undergo testing. Is it a concussion or is it not, right? But to your point is, let's say like an athlete who has, let's say, undergone a concussion, they're currently in a concussion protocol, that's a very vulnerable stage for them because they can have what's called second concussion syndrome, where like they're very vulnerable. There's now an introduction of oxidative stress due to a mild traumatic brain injury. That's what a concussion is, yeah. Right? So now that, let's say, a small shove potentially could reignite concussion-based symptoms, further pursue their stay in a concussion protocol because of that, right? So within concussion protocols, we're going to obviously look to minimize cognitive stimulus, right? So, you know, visual, audio, mental concentration, school, reading, socializing, things like that, right? To within their tolerable limit. So with concussion protocol, like we were talking with Cassandra, is that sometimes if it's very, very mild, and I can't fully remember it because I think Allie is the one who did it, but she didn't have any signs of a concussion. No. So, but let's just say in more of a...
She did have the trigger for us was she had external swelling this time on her head.
Yeah, which can happen obviously just due to the traumatic head injury component to it, right? So sometimes like it's just that, which is a good thing, yeah. Right? You just obviously want to monitor.
What's the best thing to do when that happens?
For the head like trauma?
The immediate thing to do. What's the best thing to do?
So you kind of want to look at it and evaluate and get it assessed because there are things that can sort of complicate the matter. But I would say majority of the time, it's not concerning, but it's just always one of those things you'll definitely want to get it assessed really quickly. Just go see your GP and they'll be able to kind of tell you more specifically.
What are the cause and effects? Like, I mean, I'm assuming that if it's a concussion, it gets severity. Are we talking about it starts to affect your senses in your head?
Well, exactly. Just from let's say the bump on the scenario, right? But if we're talking concussion, right? You definitely go see a doctor too. The one thing I would always say is that if there's nausea and you're vomiting or they have vomited, go straight to the ER. That's one hallmark sign. It's something quite severe. Mm-hmm. So like if they vomit, straight to the ER. Like if someone like hits their head, they're really nauseous. They end up throwing up. you know, as you kind of monitoring them, you're kind of doing your initial, let's say, pitch side, like sports side. Like let's for example, if I'm pitch side, someone has a head injury and they feel nauseous, we're monitoring, we're going through all our initial concussion testing. In those scenarios, you'll quickly realize it's going to be a concussion. You're monitoring for various things. Let's say they're nauseous. Okay, we're really going to keep on top of this and monitor. If they end up throwing up or they're extremely nauseous, we're also going to look at, like, do they have a neck fracture? There's certain things we're going to want to look at. And then, right, okay, is this something that we need to go to the ER, get it looked at or not? But if it's a concussion one and they're in clinic, the standard thing is, right, we want to minimize their cognitive stimulus to a tolerable limit. And we only will find that out after an assessment. And to coming to Jonathan's point, where sometimes it can be a scenario where someone will experience a head injury, they feel fine, so you're not really thinking concussion. But then maybe 2 days later, they're demonstrating some form of symptoms of headache or pressure in their head. It's because they just went on it within their normal day to day, and they've probably reached a point where their cognitive load, whether it be at school as they're trying to concentrate, do homework, socialize with friends. And then the other component too, it is with exercise. So increasing their heart rate, all of this will be sort of the peak sort of provocations for concussion. And so then they can experience symptoms because it was very, very mild that they required all of these aggravating factors for them to experience a concussion symptom. Mm. And so that's how that can sometimes happen.
Okay, can I challenge this for a second? Because there's ignorance that shows up for me. When you talk about, okay, go to the ER. Even you, no matter how many times you tell me, there's still a brain block that says, I'm not going to go to the ER. It's not mission critical. It's not life or death. There's many people ahead of us in this scenario that could use the treatment. Why ER?
So it's one of those things where you want to, like when we say it clinically in our profession, we want to rule out red flags. So it's the risk versus reward. Like the risk is nothing to get a quick scan, x-ray or otherwise.
So hang on. So you're going to go to the emergency room because they're going to do an MRI or a scan or some sort? Is that what the intention is?
The intent is if we're worried about that, and I wouldn't know necessarily off topic of the percentages, right? But sure, we just have standard red flags that you want to fully evaluate to rule out, right? Because if there's demonstrations of signs or symptoms that we identify as red flags, like these could be medical emergencies, we just need to rule that out. For the safety of the individual, we need to rule it out, right? We always hope that, like, it's like, so you as a parent, I guess you're gonna be like, well, why would I go? It's gonna be like nothing wrong. We're hoping for that. But the individual, like, let's just say, right, if it's your daughter, we're going to make sure we're going to exhaust all options that it's not a medical emergency. Because the last thing we would ever want, right, is, okay, there's a warning sign here, but you know what? It's likely going to show negative, so let's not do it. For the one in whatever it might be, it's not. And in which case, the consequence of that is so severe that we need to make sure. Mm-hmm. So when we identify red flags, we need to address them. There are yellow flags, which, okay, they're more cautionary. Let's monitor where it might be like, okay, you don't have to go to ER, but like monitor if this changes into, you know, this sign or symptom, right, definitely now go to ER. But if someone is demonstrating red flags with a concussion or there's other scenarios in which pathologies, which we'll look out for, straight to the hospital, x-ray. We want to see if it's x-ray required or a CT. We want to rule out all like red flags for that medical emergency.
Thank you. So the next thing that shows up is that, let's assume it's not an emergency room visit. There are other protocols, which I've heard you mention before. I want to dig into things that could support recovery. And, you know, the words that come up to me are creatine. Do omegas tie into that? What do you suggest from your knowledge and expertise?
Yeah, so creatine's been quite prevalent within concussions, I think, for a while now, in terms of like in an academic sense when we look at clinical studies. I think now it's slowly becoming, in certain elite level sports, a lot more prevalent as we understand more and more about its neuroprotective and its cognitive benefits. And you're starting to see it leak out into more public senses. I'm not too sure on what it's like in its general practice of concussions, but
what's it doing exactly? I mean, creatine it goes towards muscles, doesn't it?
So that's one component, is like the musculoskeletal side of things, but there is a cognitive component to it. And we can digress further beyond that, is that, so creatine is something that can cross the blood-brain barrier, and that is what we use as energy within our brains. And so it is protective against oxidative stress for, you know, mild traumatic brain injuries, things like that, where like there is an oxidative stress present. And so it's quite protective of it. So you're seeing, let's say, there's various studies coming out with certain doses, which are pretty high, but you'll see a lot of elite level athletes where there is a lot of head contact taking creatine for neuroprotective, because it does obviously help alleviate any oxidative stress that can then be induced via concussion, right? So there's a protective component to it. One, two is then, let's say if you just weren't taking it prior to a concussion sense, it will help alleviate symptoms because it does have protective mechanisms to reduce your oxidative stress within a brain injury that is currently transpiring.
How much are the pros taking and how much are should regular people
take? I think, like, I don't think there's a standardized dosage on what pros, because you'll hear various ones. I know some people will take 20 grams. I would just say standard, like, assuming everything is fine and healthy for someone to take it, the standardized 5, mm-hmm. Which is typically one scoop, will be more than sufficient. To go beyond that, there are studies to say, like, you're not the... The benefits you'll get aren't really there.
It doesn't compound.
No. Okay. But there are people taking like 20 grams a day. So there is a variance to it. There's no one standardized.
Hey, homeowners and businesses, are you looking for top-notch tile and stone services you can trust and count on? Consider the expert tradesperson behind the Tile Guy GTA. Omid himself. He takes pride in delivering quality service and professional installation on time and on budget. From mosaics to large slabs to custom niches and miters, the Tile Guy GTA has you covered. With years of experience and a commitment to excellence, Omid and the team at the Tile Guy GTA are your go-to professionals for all your tile and stone needs. From full waterproofing solutions of every possible product to the finish, grouting details, even a hint of design recommendations when the client needs to hear the truth. Call the Tile Guy GTA today, 647-716-5062, or email them at thetileguy.gta@gmail.com. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
Component
then
to
the
it.
Pros are actually pushing their bodies to a certain point than versus the average
person. Well, it depends on what your objective is for it, right? Is it performance side? Is it neuro, like, protective or cognitive component? Because there are cognitive benefits to it too, right? So because creatine is an energy source for your brain, it does help with memory, quick decision making, fatigue, brain fog, which are all symptoms of concussion, right? So because it's, with a concussion, it's different than let's say a physical injury. Now it's your cognitive stress tolerance, right? So like I said, so cognitive load could be any forms of visual stimulus, audio, light sensitivities, mental focus, concentration, things in those natures. So obviously when we can obviously help that, it will provide a benefit. So that's why concussions and creatine will be beneficial. And then slowly, then part of your concussion protocol is introducing more and more cognitive stimulus to a tolerable level. So we'll work on various things to help improve that as it relates to the individual with what they're struggling with, and then bring them into a return to sport concussion protocol, which is then different.
But our bodies produce creatine.
Yes. Like, so we have natural stores. Yes. So what this will do is increase those baseline levels.
But do children or younger people have greater storage amounts of creatine versus, does it?
Yes. So as we age, that we do have less and less, and females have less than men.
Okay.
It is in food, right? So it's one of those, like, it's probably, it's most definitely the most studied supplement that there is. It's one of the safer ones, but you still need to be careful with it, that, you know, there are certain liver or kidney conditions where, like, it might be mindful to definitely, I would always make sure you check with your doctor first.
But I mean, we're not saying that you're not going to get Cassandra started on a sippy cup with creatine in it. You know what I'm saying?
No, but I'm saying, you know, so, okay, so she smashes her head, mm-hmm. right? You know, do I say, here, you know, have 2.5 milligrams of creatine because we want to make sure that, you know, that brain doesn't swell. Or, you know, I don't know.
Would that help?
So like it would help that there is, there are studies that demonstrating that there are no risks or adverse effects at all ages. There is always a, you know, guideline. I think Health Canada has it at the age of 16, something like that for creatine. Not completely certain on that one.
We're supposed to still help, listen to Health Canada?
Yeah. So it's just one of those.
She's not going to go on it. She's just, yeah, you know, like.
Like, I'm not going to sit here and pound the table. Hey, Jonathan, you know, Cassandra's got to go on creatine.
There's protocols, right? Smashes her head. I was always brought up with, don't let the child sleep. You know what? She's exhausted. You know what she's going to do? Sleep. Let her sleep. So I, protocol, you know, I turn on binaural beats, calm the brain, her. You know, have some, I have given her creatine before, but only immediately, right? Like to say, try this. I don't know if it does anything, right?
Like it will help in that scenario. If you said you gave to her for that.
Right after the incident here, have a little bit, right? Is it going to help? I don't know.
Right? Yeah. Like it's going to be hard to know. Right. And it's just one of the things you got to be weary of.
Yeah, of course.
That's why I said like, you kind of always want to make sure medically, cause you just don't ever know. But in terms of like what you were saying, like immediately after, like, creatine aside, is that you want to minimize their cognitive stimulus. And so to tell you how much would be very difficult, each one is very, very relative to the individual.
You'd rather have the assessment first before.
Yeah, we would need to know, because then that's how we could help manage it, right? Yeah. Like talking in generalities right now, I can't say specifically, right? Because each person will have a different tolerance to any one of the various factors, visually, cognitively, in terms of cognitive working, homework or otherwise, socially, reading, just light sensitivities or, you know, even motions, right? Like just movement. So in any one varying degree, we can then sort of manage accordingly to, let's say the parent, let's say, Jonathan, right, this is how we want to manage it. We're going to lessen these and these. She's okay with maybe movements. So we never actually want to do nothing. We want to promote activity, but not exercise. There's a very specific discrepancy difference.
Yeah.
So it's always minimizing to their most active tolerable limit and staying within that. And so it's not about staying in a cold, dark room and do nothing. No, it's, let's identify where their cognitive stress level is and then stay within that. And then we slowly progress that further. We want them, like, you know, if they can tolerate a walk for 10 minutes, that's fantastic. We want activity, but we don't want exercise. And so
balancing and everything?
Sorry?
Balancing?
What do you mean balancing?
Just making sure that they have balance, right?
So how balance will then come into playing with it a bit more different is that, so there's various components we identify with balance, because we'll use our visual components or our eyes to identify where we are in space, our vestibular system, which is our proprioception, is kind of what gets affected when we get, let's say we drink too much alcohol, that's why we feel a little off. And then our somatosensory feedback, which is like our feet. And so we play with each one of those three things to challenge the individual, because it will have a disturbance both visually as that pertains to their cognitive load, and then vestibularly speaking. That's why you hear someone undergo concussion rehab with vestibular-based rehab. And so balance is sort of that quote-unquote tool to expose them to a certain degree of challenge to, you know, get their vestibular or their visual stimulus to a certain.
It's a discovery assessment.
We want to see their limitations, right? What is the most provocative capability, right? And so the balance is used as a form of assessment. Is it more vestibular? Is it more visual? The somatosensory isn't necessarily going to be too much affected, but we can knock that out and assess heavily more so vestibular-wise, visually-wise, to then say, okay, hey, here's probably where we stand. Let's kind of rehab from this point and then move forward from there.
Should we be conscious? Because I'm just trying to think of, as you guys were talking about that in situations, are parents more comfortable if a child or an adult is wearing a helmet? So I'm thinking about whatever, like T-ball. But then if a ball hits that kid really hard on that helmet, are we just dismissing it, going, that's the reason for the helmet? But it could still get through the helmet
and
cause some damage, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking cycling helmets, motorcycling helmets, T-ball, sports helmets, hockey, all those kinds of helmets, right?
Yeah, and so good question. But the disconnect is that, so the primary role for helmets, and they've evolved now to obviously lessen the impact, but the primary role with that hard shell is to stop skull fractures, right? So it's from you just cracking your head wide open.
You can still shake your brain, though, with the helmet hit.
Exactly, right? So that's why you'll see people still undergo a concussion with that sort of head injury and a helmet. The main primary role of the helmet is like stop your head fracture or potentially anything worse. So it's to stop death. But it will obviously naturally lessen the impact of force that is coming onto the head with a helmet. So it'll go from just stopping a head fracture or something more fatal to equally potentially lessening the impact of the injury to the head to potentially lessen the concussion, but we can't say indefinitely it will. Yeah. But that's the primary role. What it then does is unfortunately give, whether it be a parent or an athlete who is wearing one, this false sense of security, right? So that's kind of coming into what you're asking there, is that pseudo sense of security. I have a helmet, so it couldn't be a concussion.
Yeah, thank goodness for the helmet.
It can. And so, but yeah, it's never that false sense of security, but it does absolutely lessen it, right? And it's always funny to me where people always think of, like, if I were to ask you guys, what is the top two sports that induce concussions, what would you think they were?
Football.
Yeah, football and rugby.
Football, rugby?
Rugby, yeah.
Nice. If Cassandra wanted to get into equestrian training, would you let her?
Yeah, I've asked a few times.
Yeah, that's number one for concussion.
That's horse. Number one, huh?
Yeah.
Really?
So it's funny. I always like it with parents. I joke with parents. I love joking with people. They'll be like, I don't want to, I'm not sure about getting my kid into football. I'm like, would you let your kid ride on a horse, train on a horse, do equestrian-based training?
That's a very good point.
And they'll be like, oh, yeah. And I'll be like, you realize that's the number one sport for concussions, right? And then they're kind of quiet. I'm like,
and the way you fall too, right?
Yeah, you're falling off a horse, and then God forbid that horse falls on you. Like,
oh gosh,
yeah, right. Like, now listen, these are like the most extremes, right? But like, it's just more to identify that to people or parents, is that like, there's a minimum risk we all accept. Like, a head injury can happen across the board.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying let's add more risk to that, but just to kind of give you a bit of perspective.
Yeah, like, you know, you said something like, "What do we do? Bubble wrap our kids? Come on."
Yeah.
Come on, like, there's got to be that assumption of risk.
Yeah.
Right? You want to play the sport, you're, as an athlete, yeah, you but know what you get into.
We never thought about head injuries.
Yeah.
We thought about scraped knees and scraped elbows. We never thought about head injuries.
Because we think of, like, what's so obvious, what's so fatal that, like, okay, we don't understand these other things that have long-term implications, right? And, you know, it's becoming more and more relevant in our society now with concussions that we're like, okay, trying to monitor and lessen that. But you can't, to a degree, right? I always say you got to let a kid be a kid.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, soccer is the most played sport in Canada now. It has been for a while. Like, if I were to tell you, like, heading the ball is pretty dangerous, right? Especially if a goalie, you know, punts the ball, that's pretty far. The trauma it's going to hit onto a kid's head as they try to header it. Like, that's one of the coaching points. Don't let that ball bounce. Like, that's pretty spicy. So, like, are we just going to start saying, okay, can't header the ball, right? Are we going to start heading the ball? I can't ever see that coming into play. So it's always about providing perspective of kind of what we're saying and what we're thinking.
They got rid of dodgeball.
Yeah.
Day, I was told.
Do you remember when we used to play, like, Red Whip or Red Ass?
Red Ass.
A ball as hard as you can at your friends?
Yep.
Good times. Or, like, when you're, like, in elementary school, there's ice, you got never got happier. Tackle football. Oh, man, you come in, like, probably concussed. I had, like, six sacks, 400 passing yards, 6 touchdown catches.
I just came up with something. We could do a cigar night with dodgeball.
That would be interesting. I'm not sure how we actually execute that.
We have to watch the movie Dodgeball first. If you could,
I say we just play the dodgeball first and have the cigar afterwards.
No, but then after you start drinking and smoking, you're going to want to play dodgeball again.
Naturally.
To retaliate.
Well, then listen, I just say we have a redemption match, right? And then just make that one way more fun.
Yeah, but then you'll get a whole truckload of patients showing up at your doorstep because we're all going to be injured.
Well, I don't see how that's a problem. It only sounds like
that'll be a good thing. Right?
Yeah. I'll give you a prorated deal. We'll consider the assessment on the day of.
But you never really do think about these head, and it takes one simple little action that something can happen, right?
Yeah, and we're so far removed of what what we used to do to handle it. Like I was telling Jonathan off camera, like I used to play hockey at a high level prior to playing soccer at an elite level. And it's crazy because it was a bad concussion, but I used to play defense. I was pretty fast. So I got into the corner of the boards first and the guy didn't really want me to get there first. So hacked my both skates and I went full speed head first into the boards, out cold for 10 minutes. And normally in those scenarios, if someone's out cold, you want to stabilize them, head and neck. There's a certain protocol. You're not trying to move them. Needless to say, how it was obviously managed in my scenario, the training wasn't there back then. And they're moving me and this, that, and the other. And obviously in that scenario, you're immediately off the ice. You're not playing. I didn't miss a shift. So
just kept going.
Yeah, and I'm also a kid. Like I was in grade six, so I don't know how old you are, whenever that is. Like, I wasn't none the wiser. I'm like, the coach asked, like, you feel fine? I was like, yeah, I was fine. Let's go. Obviously, I'm very ticked off, and I want to get revenge, which I tried to make sure I did, which I did, and got suspended for two games, which made me miss 2 weeks, which back then I would go to a doctor. Yeah, it's a concussion. You know, don't play for 2 weeks, and that's it. And now we're missing an integral component to it, which is that return to sport protocol, right? And so you're coming back into how it's managed, and I'll kind of just touch on it briefly, is that you need to be symptom-free with your day-to-day first before we can then start the introduction of exercise. And so there's a gradient scale in which we then introduce it, all while you have to be symptom-free to move on to the next one. So immediately after the first stage is right, 15 minutes, heart rate at a certain max percentage. So we'll probably go like 70%, 60% for 15 minutes. How you feel? You feel okay? Great. So we can move on to the next, slowly integrating them back into someone's sport. And so,
the come full circle on this, the thing that's sort of buzzing around my head is, knowing what we know today, is there certain things, supplements, maybe other than creatine, if we're talking youth athletes, that we can help to strengthen our brain to help mitigate concussion symptoms? You know, is there something that's like, yeah, you know what, we've got enough research to suggest, try this supplement, take this one. What does your knowledge suggest?
In terms of like supplement stuff.
Or lifestyles, foods, I don't know.
Yeah, so obviously we want to, like, not much supplement-wise that I'm too aware of beyond the creatine. That's kind of been something that's been standardized, like I said, in through the research of it.
And hang on, just hang out there. Yeah. Just last thought on that one is, it's heavily researched and it's an abundant. I mean, you can walk a show, you have a choice of 60 different types of creatine. So it's a matter of, you know, do your own research, folks, and find.
Well, what's really in there?
Find a gold standard, right?
Well, obviously I don't make them, so I couldn't tell you, but you do want to find a good quality one.
A reputable
one.
Brand.
Yeah, reputable brand. So there are a couple out there that do exist that you can get a reputable brand and quality creatine from. So that would be obviously a massive emphasis. Yeah. I think that the Perfect Sports one is pretty good. You know, I've known them thoroughly for a long time, that they're a high quality brand.
That's a name that keeps on coming up.
Yeah,
for sure.
So that's the one I personally use. That's not to say everyone has to use that, but you know, that's the one I use and it's a good quality product through and through. So,
you doing a flavored one?
No, I do unflavored.
Yes, I never like the flavored one.
Yeah, so
any of it.
I do unflavored. And the one thing I always talk about it too is that, so because creatine and actually caffeine fight for the same receptor, you want to just avoid your caffeine consumption with creatine consumption. And so I'm a caffeine.
Never mixed the two, no.
Well, don't.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but I'm also like a caffeine fiend. So I typically then will just take my creatine right before bed just because I'm really not going to have caffeine before it or after it. So there's no specific window. Just take it.
Time, yeah.
Yeah, take it whenever. But you just on the thing of creatine and kind of in the mental space that we work in too, is that like another one too that I don't think it gets enough recognition for is for mental health. And so in depression, it's actually shown to be quite effective.
Creatine?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know.
What does it do?
So people with depression have decreased levels of creatine in their brain, right? It's one of our form of energy sources in our brain, the primary source of it. So creatine supplementation alongside medication and exercise is like the best combination shown to actually help someone with depression.
Protect your investment one drop at a time. Your home or project deserves the very best when it comes to waterproofing. Trust nothing less than the service that guarantees you peace of mind and lasting protection. Meet Antonio, the expert behind Aquastop waterproofing. Whether you're a homeowner wanting to keep your basement dry or a contractor in search of a reliable partner, Antonio and his skilled team deliver unparalleled quality and service. From the first site assessment to the final backfill, every detail is handled with precision, ensuring your project is completed on time, on budget, and to the highest standard. Antonio's team doesn't just solve problems, they prevent them. With a proven track record of working with insurance companies, educating clients, and using the best products available, Aquastop Waterproofing offers a solution you can depend on for years to come. Experience the difference with a team committed to excellence. Antonio and Aquastop Waterproofing are your go-to professionals for all things waterproofing. Get in touch with Aquastop Waterproofing today at 647-631-4144 or visit them at www.aquastopwaterproofing.ca. For direct inquiries, email Antonio at antonio@aquastopwaterproofing.ca. Let's make sure your property stays safe and sound, rain or shine. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's studies behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So there's, I remember there was one, it was like just medication alone, creatine medication, obviously assuming, like severely contact your medical practitioner to ensure all of this stuff, right? I'm not saying like everyone who feels depressed, go take creatine. But, and then obviously creatine supplementation and the creatine supplementation with exercise, like, yeah. It was.
What are some of the foods that are high in creatine?
Like meats are pretty
beefs,
high,
right? Like,
yeah.
Meat beefs, right?
Yeah. Okay. So like they're the highest, but they're still not high. Mm-hmm. So
compared to supplements, right?
Yeah. Right. So like, and always like food first, right? Supplement second, like, let's be obvious with it, right? Magnitude of effect size. So, you know, obviously prioritize your diet to make sure it's covering all your requirements and then supplement as required. But yeah, so meats are probably the best source.
What's the runner up to creatine that maybe everyone is, it would be just protein whey? Like, I'm just trying to think of a supplement. I mean, back in my 20s, I had to build a cupboard to assume all the containers that you were using, right?
Whether yeah.
It was creatine, protein whey, glucosamine, whatever. There was a bunch of stuff. Glutamine.
Yeah, glutamine. Yeah, yeah.
There was a bunch of stuff. And you would just be networking with your friends talking, oh, I just discovered this. I just read this in Muscle and Fitness, and I just read this. And then you're like, yeah, but we're not those men. We're not those people that are need that muscle mass
and
energy.
The problem is with a lot of that, though, I call it like bro science or gym science. It's a lot of science. Yeah. It's a lot of misinformed anecdotal evidence, meaning like things that people will hear based off of their experiences. And so if we were talking about where that ranks on the totem pole of validity, it's at the bottom, right? So you really don't want to go off of anecdotal, like, oh, like my friend Jim said this because he's a bodybuilder. That doesn't give him any credibility of knowing physiology or biochemistry or reading any form of academic research. Yeah. So let's just take that into context. So, you know, that's kind of what we always want to prioritize, right? And so any form of recommendation just equally needs to be then, as we talked at the top of this podcast, made related to the context of the individual. I'm not saying this is a one prescription for all. It's just, this is the information we know. And the beauty of academia is that, like, we never actually provide more clarity. We only provide more questions, right? Because like, okay, if we understand this, what else? How does this interplay with other things? And so it's like almost like unclearing more of a, you know, blurred out web. But each one now is asking more questions.
I can only assume because, I mean, I don't look at magazines, but back in the day when we were reading all this stuff, you almost read these articles and they came across, tried to come across at a medical perspective, but they still felt advertising. You know what I mean? It became almost like an advertorial editorial or some shit like that.
So,
right?
And like, correct me if I'm missing your point or question, is that, like, so there's an actual difference between like a commercial based study, which, so the companies will utilize the methodology to manipulate. Like, I've done them for companies before, and I've also done academic ones. So there's a distinct difference, right? In an academic one, the methodology has to be very clear and tight to minimize or negate confounding variables. So things that can bias a result. On the commercial side of things, like, a company will hire you to, they'll look to say, hey, I want to advertise a specific statistic. can you obviously devise a methodology to, obviously you're going to confound the hell out of that thing to manipulate the result to demonstrate what they want. So in these magazines, they're going to be using studies or professionals sometimes that they'll try to lean on their degrees or pedigree to advertise, when in actuality, if anyone wants to know anything, straight up Google Scholar, and now you're looking up academic articles. But within that, though, like, it doesn't mean just because you're there, you're going to read great articles. You can read a BS one from a journal, from, you know, Journal of Bullshit Academia 101, and their impact factor is like zero, and they're just basically willing to publish any study. So that doesn't necessarily give it validity and credibility. And even then, the methodology of whatever studies you're reading, which the average person won't know, that it could be very flawed or horrible, that it's still not a valid thing to be sort of advocating for. So it's very much a skill that, like, I would say, you know, for someone like myself going through a postgraduate degree, like, I got okay at, and I didn't really get anything good till even like years beyond that, that you have to, it's a skill you have to continuously practice. And so it's not fair for the gen pop to say, okay, hey, like, go and do this, right? So you kind of want to find credible sources with individuals that you find are being fully informed, that you're not just looking for cherry picking evidence of articles where it's right, this is supports a bias. You want to look to both sides. And when you do that, you can then be very, very effective, because right, normally this is what we know about this supplement, let's just say creatine, but for you, you fall in this specific category where it might not be.
This is no different than every other, you know, conversation where people just hear one thing and they latch on, like, this is the way it is.
Well,
like,
it's influencing, right? It's influencing.
So
I guess the version of today that the magazine of yesterday would have been just influencers today. Yeah. My red flag that comes up is when someone's announcing something to be taken, but they're actually specifically telling you what product it is and giving you the full description of the product.
Right.
And I want to get the understanding of what's inside that product,
right,
and that's the cause and effect of what I should be taking.
Yeah.
But as soon as I see them endorse a specific product or line or something like that, I'm like, well, this is just an advertisement at that point.
Oh, 100%. And that's what I was saying. Like, they will lean
on. You
wouldn't
see that in the scholar academic.
Well, you can, right?
So sometimes that's why there's a fine line now. So have they been manipulated where, can you just maybe suggest this into it?
So the like, if you're like, how do I say it? Like, they're all just like lines of filters, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so if you go in Google Scholar, okay, like, at least you got the first line filter, right? Now you can, there's different layers to it to really try to get as good of an article as possible when you're reading it. And so just because you're reading an article now doesn't mean it's a good article. Like I said, there are biases.
Yep.
Certain clinical trials can be sponsored by certain companies.
Mm.
And for academia ones, they have to disclose it. So you got to be careful. So you have to read, like, people will just read an abstract, which just shows the result, and they'll be like, okay, this is effective. Mm, look at the methodology, right? And then look, is there bias? And so they will typically state that. So you just got to make sure what you're reading's legit, which is unfair to ask the gen pop to do that.
Let's talk about liver.
Right? I want to talk, because I know you first brought this up and I was fascinated by that liver scan, right?
Yeah, and I did. It was cool.
So fortunately for us that we've been able to bring on a FibroScan, which is the sort of one of the gold standard liver scans. We just actually hosted a liver clinic day, was it in April.
Is this new technology?
Newer. It's been around for quite a while. I'm not sure on the amount of time, but I definitely want to say it's newer. I'd probably say in around a decade or longer. I'm not specifically certain. Someone can look it up and know indefinitely, but it's revered in an academical sense. Published wise, like, as one of the gold standards, it's been utilized as a tool to measure liver health in like over 4,200 published studies. So it's something that, like, let's say if a doctor wants to know more about the condition of someone's liver as it pertains to hepatitis or any sort of liver cirrhosis, like, this is what they're going to go and do, right?
What would they do before a biopsy?
Well, like it's just one of the things they'll do within it. So it's never a sort of reactionary sense. Okay, the liver biopsy. It's going to depend on the individual, right? So typically, a hallmark sign that you're going to start to notice something will be they'll look at your blood. So there's different biomarkers within that. They'll do this. Like you're trying to garner as much information as possible to then obviously help the individual. And what this will do is give you very much an objective marker of your liver tissue scarring, right, as well as your liver fattiness.
Okay.
And so, which is people don't necessarily think of or take it for granted, be like, oh well, like I'm young or I exercise or I work out. Like everyone who came in that day quite virtually had a fatty liver, and there was individuals there who
what was the age group like?
Oh, how old? I think the youngest was probably my brother, actually. He didn't have a fatty liver, but like he was still medically fine, but like for someone like himself, it should have been lower. But there, to give you another example, is that like there's people who work out, exercise, eat pretty decent, but then had a fatty liver. And it's like, oh, okay, like you're not cognizant of it. It just makes you very aware. So it's very imperative to kind of see that objective number, like, okay, where am I? It's not like you have to do overly drastic things because you're probably doing a lot of good things. It's like, okay, hey, at least now I'm aware of this. I can try to kind of, let's bring this in check, right? And it's not something that they'll have to make massive changes for, but it's definitely something that they can work on to reduce. And so a fatty liver doesn't have massive short-term effects in terms of its harm, but definitely significant long-term implications. So it's something that you want to get, you know, resolved, and you won't know it indefinitely of where you stand, because typically one of those things will be like, right, a blood test will tell you, great, let's scan the liver and we can actually have a real objective number of like, okay, where is it at? And then the individual can work on lowering that as they move forward, just to a healthy medical norm.
Right? Can you unpack the distinct difference between a fatty liver and scar tissue around the liver?
So like liver scarring will be more of like the tissue makeup is actually having physiological change. So that's starting to really impair function.
Caused from what?
From a host of different reasons. So it could be like hepatitis, cirrhosis, like excessive drinking, obesity and stuff, but like long-term liver fattiness, right?
It starts to deteriorate the liver, and that's what's causing the scarring?
Yeah, so like it's you're affecting the tissue quality of your liver cells. And so now they're going to change. And so they will then start scarring.
They actually become hard, do they not?
Well, yeah, it'll be like that's one of the forms it'll come into, right? It'll change its cellular structure as well, right?
Okay.
So that's kind of like the worsening consequence of it, right? And then that'll start to play into showing other more severe medical implications of liver issues, right? So liver fattiness, like that's where I said like the short term of it, it's not necessarily something that you need to be too concerned of in that moment of like it causing liver impairment, as much as it will then, if it's sustained, then have that long-term implication.
Got it.
So it's just more so a scan to be aware of where you are and in sort of that medical side.
And it's reversible.
Yeah. Like the fattiness, you can get your liver fat down.
Yeah, over time, you just have to change your diet, I guess. And
it's quite simply your sugars. Okay. So, for example, like when we had everyone in clinic, you know, they ate pretty good. They're pretty clean, very, very active individuals. They work out like 5 times a week. Liver fattiness, right? They're in their 40s. You wouldn't think that, right? If you looked at them, you probably wouldn't think, hey, they have liver fattiness. They were already told by their doctor, like they do have some liver fattiness, right? So obviously this individual is very, very keen on identifying more and learning more. And well, obviously naturally had a fatty liver. And so typically where it goes is like, you just have a quick conversation with them. You know, they eat well, they exercise well, but then they also enjoy quite a few treats or desserts. So they got a bit of a sweet tooth, right? Hey, life is life. But try to maybe just manage that a bit better. Find different strategies to try and get that in check so you can come into a healthy place for yourself.
I'm just curious because I know the scan is, you were saying it was pretty simple. Like you just.
Oh, yeah.
Lift up your shirt you lift up the side of your shirt.
Yeah.
It takes like 10 minutes. They kind of go on it. You just kind of feel some pulsing vibrations. And then that's it. And you can kind of see it thereafter, like your instant scores. And then you'll obviously go through a bit of management strategies with one of our other clinicians to kind of help find ways to reduce that for you wherever you're at, alongside with it, with any other medical, you know, issues you might have that can interplay with that.
Did you guys ever test? I was just curious because I know a lot of people have been using blood sugar monitors to see if they spike when they eat something, right? But if you were to scan and then have a big piece of chocolate cake or something like that and waited a couple of hours and scanned it again, would you see a difference then?
No. So like, so with these
liver... It takes time, right?
Yeah. So with these liver scans, actually, so you don't do them all that often. There's a range. You really don't want to do it. You're not doing it twice a year. Like it's anywhere from like once to anywhere from 8 to 14 months type of thing. And so no, it takes time to
kind of discovery first of all.
Yeah.
Find out, discover. Yeah. Right. More often than not, it's going to show signs of liver fattiness. Maybe you might be borderline. Okay, cool. Like at least now, you know, and then you can just work to come into a healthier, you know, score.
To your point though, I just want to, cause I actually asked that question of the technician walking in there. It was on a Tuesday, I think, and the Saturday before we had an event and, you know, I was consuming alcohol, which, so I said, hey man, coming off of a bender of a Saturday, is it going to affect it? And he's like, no, he says, this is long-term, man.
Yeah.
This is like your status today is as a result of the past 12 months.
Pretty much what you did in your 20s.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so much in your 20s,
right?
but like,
well, you know, you check again in 12 months, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So like it's not like, hey, you just like a glucose response. And so then even to the other side of it is that like, well, people think, okay, look, I'm going to get on top of it really quickly. And then I'm like, scan me in a month. And so what ends up happening actually, what's pretty neat is that like, well, now your liver thinks you're going to be in extreme famine. So it's going to hoard more fat. So if you were to like, okay, get extremely, you know, strict and disciplined, and then you want to scan it in like whatever short amount of time thereafter, your liver fattiness score will actually come up.
It'll be worse.
Yeah. Because now like your body's starting to think it's in famine, hoard all this fat that it needs to kind of keep for survival. And then it's going to show a worse score. So yeah, it's something that like first discover, and then see where you are, right?
And it's kind of sad that you said you did the test with a bunch of people and the majority of them were.
Yeah. And that's why, like, you know, like I'm more of an advocation for like just all things gold standard and signs and indications of health, right? So it was very awesome to kind of have them come in, and we're doing it again on May 6th, which is a Tuesday coming up here, and we're going to be going through it again. And, you know, even...
And if somebody wants to get on that, or is that booked already?
No, there is availability. So yeah, okay, just they can contact the clinic and then we can get them scheduled in.
What's the cost of it to do it?
So it's $160 all in. There's no taxes with it. Depending on their insurance, it can be covered. So we would just talk with the individual, like how it can be. Don't ever want to say it is or guarantee it. So there are some insurance plans. We'll never be able to find out, but we can converse with the individual that maybe this could be something that can be covered. And it'll just be the scan. You'll have your preliminary results on the spot. You'll go through it with one of our other clinicians to kind of go through some treatment and management strategies and kind of interpret those results for you, and then a hepatologist will obviously then go through a full report of it, so it's then reviewed by an MD, so a doctor, to kind of give you the full interpretation of your results, and we can then we'll both send it to you and whatever family doctor you want us to send it to.
How long is the whole procedure from the time you guys get in there, scan to assess to talk?
Probably within 30 minutes. So like 10 to 15 minutes for the scan, then sort of another 15 just with the clinician thereafter. And yeah, then you'll be on your way.
Wow. Attention aspiring tradespeople and entrepreneurs. Looking to break into the skilled trades or start your own home service business? Meet TradeLinks Consulting, your go-to partner for success. At TradeLinks Consulting, they're passionate about helping you find the right trade, build your business, and mentor the next generation. Whether you're exploring your options or ready to take the plunge, they offer tailored career consulting and startup guidance to get you on the right track. Visit them at www.tradelinkconsulting.ca today and book your personalized strategy session. Your future in the skilled trade starts here. This message is proudly supported by The Construction Life.
And it's another part to it too, is like liver function, if you will, that I always talk to. Like as people think about like the cirrhosis, the liver fattiness, I'm like another aspect as the liver interplays to, let's say, like sport and exercise, and people who might be like, well, I'm fit, I'm healthy, why would I even care about like my liver score? And it's like, well, here's where the exercise physiology comes into play, is that people always think of like lactic acid buildup as like a limitation of them doing, you know, anaerobic intensive exercise. It's actually not. That's sort of the end result of other things kind of coming into play. And so to kind of go through a brief exercise physiology or biochemistry scenario is that like when we do exercise at intense levels, we produce hydrogen and protons, which is a very acidic molecule, and our body tries to buffer that and it forms a lactic acid molecule. Yeah. And what ends up happening is that it's not necessarily lactic acid buildup is what limits us, is that our liver is actually what breaks that down to then provide glucose to then use. And what ends up being the impeding factor for us to keep going isn't that we just work out, have lactic acid buildup, is our liver's inability through, it's called gluconeogenesis, to break down that lactic acid molecule and then turn it into glucose. And so, you know, let's say when people think like, well, I'm young, I'm fit, I'm healthy, what do I care? Yeah, you probably don't, but you know, hey, you can kind of look at it in that regard as like sort of a performance aspect. Okay, where's my liver fattiness score? Like, is it kind of where it should be, right? It's a sort of a numerical, you know, inferring number to see, okay, what's the status of my liver? And if I'm like an exercise junkie who likes to do super intense stuff, right, your limiting factor of anaerobic exercise will be your liver. Right, because it can't break down lactic acid to turn it into glucose, so you will now have an accumulation of lactic acid. And people just think, well, my lactic acid high is high. Well, it's because your liver is struggling to turn that and convert that into glucose to then continuously exercise.
So when did, because I know that this is all new for us, that we're learning about fatty liver disease, which I think is now being titled non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Because it used to be back in the days, I guess 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, just people who drank a lot were damaging their liver. But now the consumption of processed foods and too much sugar in food is damaging the liver. So I'm assuming that there's more people damaging their liver from eating poorly than drinking too much.
It's going to be both, but you know, obviously it's the narrative has changed, right? Because now we're being a lot more aware of the, you know, impact that glucose has not only in the liver, but you know, beyond that, right? And so yes, the prototypical is that like alcohol, liver cirrhosis, that's not going to be good for you. That's going to heavily affect your liver. But yes, now that we come into more of this awareness of the play and harmful effects of glucose has not only on blood sugar, but other visceral organs, that is one of the more impacting factors on liver health as much as alcohol. I think people now are very cognizant to their alcohol consumption and how that plays to affect not only to their liver health, but as into their brain health as well, that they'll still drink, but they're trying to be more responsible with it. And so then neglect what they're eating. And so now that's coming to the forefront of this new light, as you're saying, okay, now it's not just drinking, it's what's my sugar intake, and then how that in plays and imparts on other factors, such as like diabetes and otherwise.
Yeah, that's where it starts to get serious.
And even like sort of how that interplays too with high sugar levels or high sugar diets with, you know, certain conditions like ADHD and things like that, right? Where you actually want to really retain that. And that's coming a hot topic too, especially as it comes into kids and children. So ever revolving door. Like I said, as we learn more and more, all we ever do is ask more questions and never provide more clarity, but only ask more questions and have more curiosity.
But by the growth of population, are we still seeing a steady incline of health issues like this, or are the health issues becoming far greater compared to how many people there are?
So they're always, well, I don't want to say always, but
it's, so if the population is going up this way and all of a sudden the health is kind of going up this way, so we're having more health problems with greater people.
We are, like, there is more prevalence of various health issues within the population, especially too as we start to age. And so a lot of what we're sort of seeing is that there's earlier onsets of various conditions, right?
Things that would have been typical in older individuals are now being seen in much younger individuals.
So, you know, like, for example, now for like colonoscopies, we're bringing down the age, right, of when you should start getting tested. So like as like one indication, right, we're seeing earlier onsets of various cardiac comorbidities and diabetes that it's happening sooner and sooner. That's right. These are things that we can get in check. And the, like you, like depending when you kind of get diagnosed with diabetes, you can reverse it. But people just, well, right, okay, I'm stuck with diabetes. Okay, this is how I manage it. Like, your intent should not just, like, depending when you are, right? If it's type 1, not happening, right? That's just a whole separate scenario. But if it's type 2 and it's early or you're pre-diabetic, you can definitely reverse it.
Yeah.
But that has to be your objective. Oftentimes people are like, okay, well, it's diabetes. They get complacent and they have this pseudo sense of safety. Well, there's medication. I know people so many people are on it. It's a common thing.
Like and you said earlier, it becomes your lifestyle.
Yeah, and it becomes your lifestyle. And so now their mindset isn't of like, well, let me try to reverse this as much as it is, okay, I'll just manage it. No, you can.
It takes years though.
Well, it depends, right? Like it depends on how far it is, right?
It'll take a period of time.
But it absolutely takes. It's not going to happen overnight.
It takes seconds to take a pill.
Yes, yes, exactly, that's the problem, right? But right? It's more about like, let's change your mindset and perspective of going from, okay, treating this from a management scenario to my objective is to try to reverse it. And so, you know, I'm not like, you can do it. You need to
get professional guidance like yourself.
100%, yes.
Where it's like, here, I got to start listening to you because, I mean, I'm not a fan of taking pills. I don't take pills, right? So yeah. It's just, I don't want to be taking pills when I get older either, right?
Yeah, and it's one of those things too where it's, I've just talked to the mindset of certain people is that it's when they have diabetes or it could be like a newer diagnosis of it and so they're trying to understand their new life with it, is that, well, they think, okay, well, I'll just do a healthier form of a carbohydrate. You probably should just avoid them altogether.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just in their mindset.
Based on your lifestyle, that's going to convert to sugar, which
yeah.
is going to
So, it's like, it's still sugar. Like, yeah. It's you want to find ways to avoid it or have healthier forms of it. Like, you know, we can digress into specifics of it, but it just in a broad perspective is that the mindset is like, well, it's not pick a, yeah, good start to pick a healthier form of it, but it, that's not the mindset, is that it's still going to spike your blood sugars quite yeah. a bit. You're missing the objective is that like, right, try to take autonomy and control over it to reverse it. And not to say, and you know, demonize carbohydrates, but then typically too, is that like, if you're just trying to focus on diet alone, which you should reverse that, but like, what is your, what's your exercise or activities level like? Because exercise will massively, to kind of come into to some science of what diabetes is, like your GLUT4 receptor, right, to bring sugar into a cell to take it out of your sugar, or sorry, your blood vessel, so that's your blood sugar. So you have less receptors, they become less responsive. Exercise will increase the responsiveness and the adaptations will be you'll have more of them, so you can uptake sugar into your muscle cell. So it's not just one, okay, I identify blood sugar through diet.
Which is energy, but you have to expel that energy. So correct. If you start consuming all yeah. this stuff and now you choose yeah. to not exercise, where does it go?
Yeah. So people like demonize carbohydrates yeah. because they don't want to exercise. Well, like the more you exercise, then maybe now you can enjoy a bit of carbohydrates, right? So it's an entire relationship of, you know, diet and exercise and that duality of the two.
Or the alternative is take a pill.
Correct. Yeah. And that's, but then we come into sort of the psyche of people, right?
Yeah.
That the convenience factor. Well, why am I going to do all of this when I can just take a pill? Right. And then what have they been conditioned to be aware of? Right. Well, I know some people who like, you know, they'll sort of internalize. I know some people on, you know, diabetes medication, it's manageable, it's tolerable. Nothing really changes. Their health seems to be fine. They get on with life. Okay. So there's no consequence. Right. So right. they think, well, there's no consequence, I can do it. But in actuality, like, why don't you work to come away from this so then you minimize everything in its entirety, right? And it's just more of the mindset of it.
I know before we got started, we were having an amazing conversation, which sometimes I wish we record because you were mentioning how you need to have an understanding of your patients and what their personal interests are. just to have that connectivity with a patient, right? Which makes a lot of sense. So you're being able to learn about whether they're kids and what activities they do or what they do as an adult and what activities they do and they appreciate. So it's like almost you're like the streaming service in your head trying to talk to people and connect with people.
Yeah, right? And you're trying to learn all this to understand it, because then your
lifestyle to kind of...
Exactly, because then you want to... That enables me, obviously, in my profession specifically, but in a broad sense, in any clinical practice, is you can be highly, highly effective. Mm-hmm. And your management strategies to that individual can enable them to be effective, right? And so then not only do you help them clinically, you'll be doing pretty well, that you can just ensure that the efficacy and effectiveness in your clinical practices is going to be at the highest it possibly can be, right? You take it into account, people can just fall off on their own. There's human behavior elements to it. But yeah, you want to learn every nuance of the individual to understand, okay, hey, no matter what my science knowledge tells me of what could be the most effective, in actuality, what is the most effective, you know, plan or management strategy for this individual based off of my science knowledge, right? So what is my academia knowledge, right? I know this to be effective, but this person sitting in front of me sits in this place between a patient population of this category with various barriers or, you know, levels of encouragement. And so right now I can refine what I'm going to be suggesting and my treatment plan to enable this person to sustain a plan that can enable them to be effective. Because the most important thing, like, it doesn't matter if I have the most effective plan on my left hand, but you...
They don't do it.
Yeah.
Well, not even that, but like, hey, I have the most effective plan, left hand, but you need it for your right hand, right? So I need you to sustain whatever, you know, management plan or treatment that you can do. And so if not, if I just suggest something, despite it being the most effective, you ain't going to do it. You're not being benefited from. And so that's why that is so important, that I'll learn as much as I can about the individual, you know, read them, their sort of, you know, nuances, their personalities, a bit of their lifestyle, like, that I can just truly then help them.
I bring that up because I think that you probably have come across clients before where it's like your atmosphere and your environment is contributing to the fall of your health.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is that your day-to-day of getting a double-double and a donut on a 5-day schedule, 6-day work schedule, whatever it is contributing to your health.
Oh yeah.
So then when you travel and you go to different parts of the world and you go to simpler parts of the world and you start meeting elderly people, they have a different look on their face and they seem happier and they seem a lot healthier, mm-hmm. because they don't have that double double donut every single morning. They have a fruit, a vegetable, a meal, a walk. Like, the atmosphere, the environment is contributing to their health in a good or a negative way, right?
Yeah. So like, environment plays a massive
100%, I think.
play into health, right? And but then it's not just as simple as like a double double and a donut, because it gets digressed into like I said, social, you know, other components to it, right? Our landscape versus other parts in the world isn't overly conducive, right? So we can digress significantly in each area, but yeah, you want to talk about the individual in that sense. Like, let's say they're like a construction worker, which tends to be your predominant audience, and they standard is stop by Tim's on your way to work or to the site, double double donut. Like, that's highly processed food. And another conversation of health in that regard is like, yeah, not only is that just sugar loaded, one, it's not satiating, so you're not going to feel full. You're going to eat again, so you're just compounding, you know, sugar, calories, whatever. That's just not conducive. And then not only on top of that, you're going to talk about like some processed stuff, really refined stuff. So, you know, if it's someone who just in the morning, they're not a big breakfast individual, or they do like to eat breakfast, like, you just discuss their lifestyle and their preferences to devise a behavior pattern and a habit for them to feel like they can do. And you know, utilizing whatever science method in the background to then obviously then get them to execute that works best for them, right? So if they obviously prefer convenience in the morning, there's different management strategies you can do, right?
Have you had to do that with a patient? Tell them, listen, change this or this is going to continue and get worse.
Yes, but not overly specific, and it's not a commonality,
okay.
Right? Just because I'll try to stick within what I do. If there's something that interplays to it, you know, we'll have like just a casual conversation of, hey, understanding and going through that. But, you know, like, you're spending money for a certain amount of time that we're going to be together, that if it's something that identify, hey, okay, you know what, we just really need to kind of unpack this for you, but I'll try not to, because, you know, you're coming in here for your shoulder. Let's try to obviously do that. There are moments in our treatment session where we can just converse. And, you know, if that's something that they're really leaning into me for advice for, I'll definitely provide that, right? Just more from a behavioral sense where it's, okay, hey, if you just provide convenience, really quickly, like a protein shake, throw a raw egg and some frozen fruit, and out the door you go. Bring your coffee in a mug. If you enjoy coffee in the morning, you need that on the go. And Tim's is like just out of tradition for you. Cool, great. Like, have your coffee, but, you know, maybe, hey, let's not do the sugar in there, yeah. Right? Just find different ways. So you're really not a person who likes to make breakfast and sit down for it. You throw this together, quick blender, take it on your go, drink it while you're driving to the site, and off you go. At least that's a healthy alternative. If they enjoy a bigger breakfast, then it's a different conversation to unpack, right?
Anything else you want to share before we wrap it up?
No, I think that's good.
We covered quite a bit.
Yeah.
Evidence-based protocols?
Is that the ad?
That was about, you know, tying in DNA and blood to, you know, nutrients.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
You know, like some of the nutrients he might need might not be the same supplements and nutrients that I might need.
Yeah, every body is different, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't that basically what it is, right? Okay. We never even shared your information in the beginning of it, but it's always there. You want to share it up?
Yeah, so clinic is Premier Physiotherapy and Sports Medicine. We're in Kleinberg. Full multidisciplinary clinic. Or email if you have any questions.
How far is it from here? Anybody who's listening has been here.
From here, honestly, depends how fast you drive. But
45 or so?
Let's just say 45.
Okay.
Yeah, say 45. We're right off the 400.
It's a highway.
400 intestines.
It's 1 hour Toronto anyway. Where yeah. Toronto goes yeah. 1 hour.
But clinic line 905-417-9991. Email us at reception@premierphysiotherapy.com.
And May 6th.
Yeah, May 6th for the liver clinic. If you're interested, yeah. Give us a shout. We can provide you as much information as possible and go through it. I actually sort of really enjoyed it myself just because I actually did scan my liver as well. It was a good score, but like when I saw it, I was like, you know what? That should be lower. Like Jonathan's was lower than mine, just for reference. So yeah, exactly, right? So even though this guy's telling me it's a good score, you know, it could definitely be lower, so.
Yeah, it's information.
It's just information. It's
information. Then you can do what you want with it. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right.
Good chat. We're out of here.